Okay, we'll bring to order the meeting of the Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Committee and start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine. Representative Dean.
Here.
Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Grossel.
Here.
Representative Howell. Representative Lohmer.
Here.
Representative Lucero. Representative Neuberger.
Ready to serve.
Representative O'Neill.
I'm here.
Representative Pinto. Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Zerwas.
Okay, I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes from March 2nd.
So moved.
Representative Frankie moves the minutes for March 2nd. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the chair will move House File 380, Representative Erdahl's bill, to re-refer to the Transportation Finance Committee. And Representative Erdahl, you want to do your amendment first?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if there is no objection, I'd simply like to delete Articles or C, 2C.
Representative Hillstrom, that you see your line 1.16 to line 1.19, would that be okay with you to delete that? We didn't give you any notice.
I have no objection to that. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. You've heard the amendment. Delete lines 1.16 through 1.19 from House File 380 to get it in the shape the author would like. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, Representative Erdahl, to your amended bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And what that did is basically left me with one provision dealing with increasing penalties for school bus stop arm violation. We all know that drivers are supposed to stop when the red stop arm comes out on a school bus. Each year in Minnesota, we survey our bus drivers to ask them to count violations that occur in one day. 2,700 drivers took part. There are about 10,000 trips a day. In the past 5 years, that's not including 2016, there were 533 school bus crashes, resulting in 7 deaths and 211 injuries to those involved. The average count in Minnesota, when they do the survey, is 400 violations per day, or approximately 72,000 violations per year. There are about 300 convictions in the average over those 5 years. We need to do something to address this. And one is to raise awareness. Just last month, there were 3 critically injured when a driver ran through a school bus operator's stop arm in Otsego. House File 380 will increase the penalty for this violation from $300 to $500. It's still a misdemeanor. I would also hope we can do other things to raise awareness, and I may consider for the next stop looking at public service announcements and things like that. It's an important safety issue. Can more be done? Is it a panacea for the problem? No. But it is a start, and hopefully people will pay more attention to this very serious violation. I do have one about 20-second video here for you dealing with an incident that happened outside of Painesville. If you look at the, maybe you'll be able to see, looking at the mirror on the bottom right portion of the screen. Mr. Kelleher, would you play this, please?
Sure. It happens fast.
Yeah, be watching. This is quick. Bus stops. There goes the arm. Just as a student was starting to go down the steps.
Did they catch the perpetrator?
Yes. The gentleman spent 245 days in jail with 2 years probation. Mr. Kelleher has just a few more thoughts and statistics here on 2016.
Mr. Kelleher, your name and title and begin.
Mr. Chair, I'm the lobbyist for the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. We greatly support this bill. And there's a letter in your packet, I believe, from the Minnesota Association of People Transportation stating that there's support for the bill as well. I think the only thing I'd really add is, right, Representative Erdahl said, in the one-day survey that we do, there's 400 or 500 violations that are reported to the State Patrol in the survey. In the last 5 years, there's only been about 800 convictions of the violation in a whole year. So as you can imagine how often this is occurring, there are not a lot of convictions. The court system seems to dismiss them, lower the penalty. They also stay the adjudication if the driver behaves themselves for, you know, 6 months. As Representative Erdahl said, this isn't a panacea, but we are trying to raise awareness of the problem. Mm-hmm. And as you can see from this video, that's pretty dramatic. That's about the most dramatic one we can find. There was one instance I would also tell you about that I saw, I didn't bring the film today, of a school bus that has stopped with the stop arm out. You can see the kids getting on and off the bus because some of our buses have cameras all the way around. There's a state patrol officer parked behind the school bus. There's a gentleman behind the state patrol officer who passes the state patrol officer on the left and passes the school bus all at the same time. People are distracted when they're driving. They're in a hurry. But people should be aware that when there's a big yellow school bus around, kids are getting on and off those buses, and it's dangerous. So I guess that's all I'd add.
Okay, member questions. Representative Johnson and then Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. It's a serious offense when they run those stop arms. I'm glad that we have the cameras on this bus showing that what can happen. The toughest part for law enforcement is the enforcement. I've tried to enforce a lot of them. I've had a few that I've been able to get to court and get convictions, but I get a lot of them with not enough information to proceed. Partial license plates, the license plates not matching the vehicles, the information, no information on the driver. As more and more as cameras become available, I believe it's going to be much easier to get these convictions and get the people into the courtroom where they belong.
Thank you. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the bill author of the testifier. So the image that you showed is a bus and a bus stop on what I'm assuming is a two-lane highway, fairly busy, might even be a county road. Do you know, as far as the incidences that happen, do they happen more in less populated areas, or is it pretty much balanced throughout? And I asked the question because a long, long time ago, I was actually a school bus driver. And I remember those incidences when people would run through the stop sign. And one of the things I always tried to do, and I'm sure that most drivers are informed, to really look to make sure that it's safe before you open the door, trying to be aware of all traffic around you. I'm assuming that the driver of this bus that had the tractor trailer fly by probably didn't open the door yet. For that student, because he was aware that this crazy person driving a big 18-wheeler would have killed the child. So if you could just speak to the number of incidences and just speak briefly about, you know, how bus drivers are trained today as far as preparation for incidences like that, that'd be great.
And Mr. Kelly, if we could get short questions, short answers, we've got 6 bills to go through, one that'll take some time, and we've got 400 South reserved to come back at 5 if we have to. Mr. Keller, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean. There are about 12,500 school buses in the state. Half the population lives in the Twin Cities. Half the population lives in rural Minnesota. So I would imagine it's pretty spread out fairly even. If I had to guess, I would think it happens more often in the Twin Cities.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, the door was open on this particular.
Okay. Representative Newberger.
The Thank you, Mr. Chair. In being mindful of time, do you have any data to show that how many of these incidences were related to people talking on cell phones?
Representative Erdahl or Mr. Kelleher?
We don't really track that kind of data. If you drive around the Twin Cities, and, you know, since I'm the school bus lobbyist, I try to keep an eye on who's driving and what they're doing while they're driving. And there's a lot of people talking on the phone driving around. And I think there's a lot of that, but we don't track that kind of statistic.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Neuberger, specifically on this one, he wasn't on the cell phone. And in the one in Otsego, the driver was not on a cell phone.
Okay. Member questions, any questions from the public? Anybody else to testify? Go ahead, sir.
Good morning.
You want to make room for him up there? And your name and title, and begin.
Thank you. Morning, Mr. Chair. Patrick Cotter, C-O-T-T-E-R. I'm a criminal defense lawyer practicing in my 15th year. I'm also a board member of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. But I started my career as a prosecuting attorney for several municipalities. I'll keep this very brief.
Good.
I certainly respect the spirit of this bill. And what we just saw on that screen is absolutely deplorable, and that man spent 245 days in jail because of it. That would not receive a diversion or a stay of adjudication or anything like that. But when you put the legislator in the shoes of the executive function, it has unintended consequences. And you are not able to take all of the factors into consideration. There are a lot of people, for example, let's say a 20 to 26-year-old who's on their parents' insurance. Most of these are actually a rather careless situation, not an intentional act, in my experience. And you're taking away the opportunity for the prosecutor to actually know the specific facts of each specific case and to tailor the consequence appropriately. It also increases the cost and the burden across the board. This will become a bigger issue in the next bill, but the same principle applies. When you start to take away the function of the prosecutor and the judge in imposing a specific consequence, you are now going to increase the cost and the time at every single level of the process in the judicial system, from law enforcement's time to prosecutor's time to the court's time and so on. Mr. Chair.
I'm just wondering what you're talking about here, because we deleted that section and we aren't changing anything in statute on burden of proof or anything else. All we're doing is taking an existing statute and increasing the fine. So maybe you thought we were on a different bill.
Mr. Chair,
I didn't realize we.
I was just program. Handed this as I approached, and
never mind.
Okay, that's never mind would work. Thank you.
No problem.
Appreciate it.
I've done the same thing. Catherine Turner, Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Is that the same?
That's the same.
Worry you had. Okay, if there's nobody else to testify and no other questions, we can probably renew the motion for health, unless you have a 5-second closing comment.
No, it's good. Thank you.
Okay, chair would move House File 380 be referred as amended to the Transportation Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you very much, Representative Rudolph.
Thank you.
Thank you for your work on this bill.
We did. Year
Representative Marquardt, House File 1754. Chair will move House File 1754 to be referred to taxes. Are there any amendments? Okay, to your bill, Representative Marquardt. Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is going to protect those people who are filing their taxes. Right now, we are in the income tax filing season, and many people hire someone to do those taxes for them. In fact, about 1.7 million income tax filers had someone do that for them that they paid. And this information, when you are doing your income tax, is probably the most personal information that someone else is going to have on you. And when you do that, you have full faith that your identity is going to be secured and that your proper amount paid in or the proper amount refund is going to come back to you. What this bill does, it addresses some of the bad actors out there, folks who are preparing taxes that deliberately and fraudulently do incorrect returns. And the Department of Revenue has worked with the CPA world out there for a couple years now to come to some sort of a bill that targets, really limits and targets on those bad actors of those who are preparing income tax filings. And so the reason we're here today is because it does enhance some penalties. And so to go into more details on that, I have Assistant Commissioner of Revenue, Terry Steenblok, and if she could proceed and just go over those few points that I think why we're here today.
Oh, ma'am, go ahead and introduce yourself and begin.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Terry Steenblok, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Individual Taxes at the Department of Revenue. And all of you should have a handout that states paid preparer compliance in your folder. I'm just going to briefly touch on a portion of that document, but there's more information for you should you want to review it later. And I want to thank Representative Mark Court for bringing this bill forward. This is an issue that is a serious issue, and we really appreciate his support here today. I do want to emphasize that this bill is focused on the unlicensed tax preparers who do not have any standards in place today and act in an unethical or a fraudulent manner. And what I'm going to briefly just touch on is the middle portion of that one-page document that talks about what this bill does. So this bill would create some new enforcement tools to help combat this problem with preparers in this particular area. So what this does is it allows the Commissioner of Revenue to be able to order a cease and desist order against somebody that is either acting unethically or in a fraudulent manner. I do want to state that before that order would be issued, that the individual that is for would have the right to an administrative hearing if they chose to do that. If the individual does not adhere to the cease and desist order that is put into place, then it would allow the commissioner to assess a fine. The commissioner would be allowed to assess a fine up to $5,000 if they continue to operate after the cease and desist order. In the event that we had to go and get go to court for an injunction, then the courts would be allowed to assess a fine up to $10,000. We are also implementing a new $500 penalty for a ghost preparer. And basically what a ghost preparer is somebody that files return for a fee, but they fail to put their identification number on the return. So preparers have what is called a PTIN, which identifies them as a preparer. They file numerous returns for compensation, but they don't identify themselves. So if they fail to identify themselves, this bill would allow us to assess a $500 penalty if they're purposely withholding that information from us. It also expands and coordinates the standards and penalties for unlicensed preparers in that it identifies standards that are clearly communicated to individuals, things such as you should not intentionally falsify information on a return. It expands and clarifies that the Department of Revenue, what our requirements are in reference to posting names. So in today's world, we can post a name on the website for somebody who's done this for 90 days. This allows us to expand that time frame to three years for individuals who have participated in fraudulent or unethical behavior. And then finally, this bill, in today's world, it would expand to all tax types. So today, it wouldn't just be individual income tax. It would be preparers who filed both income and business tax returns. And with that, we will thank you again for having us today and stand for any questions.
Thank you very much. Question, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would this apply to nonprofits that have to fill out tax information?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it would not. There is an exclusion in the bill that specifically excludes those that are members of our VITA sites where they prepare returns for no fee.
Okay. Thank you. Gino Fragnito of Minnesota Society of CPAs, are you here? Redford, introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Gino Fragnito, the Government Relations Director at the Minnesota CPA Society, and as Representative Marquardt said, we have worked with the department for a while on this bill, and we thank them and Representative Marquardt for bringing it forward. Regulation of unlicensed paid preparers is a topic that has been and continues to be discussed in many states and at the federal level, and the underlying issue in most of these discussions is deceptive, predatory, unethical, and sometimes fraudulent actions by these unlicensed preparers. For many unethical paid preparers, it's not a lack of knowledge, but rather intentionally misapplying the knowledge they have and willfully filing fraudulent returns and preying on unsuspecting taxpayers. Minnesota currently has a structure and statutes in place that regulates the practice of accounting and licensed professionals. The federal government also has a structure that regulates those who practice before the IRS. Neither the state nor the IRS currently regulates the practice of unlicensed preparers. CPAs, attorneys, and enrolled agents who must pass exams and complete annual continuing education are regulated under various different state and federal regulations, would be exempt from the provisions of this bill, for most of the provisions anyway. Having said that, our reason for supporting this comes down to a question of public protection and the protection of a taxpayer's personal financial information. There are many unlicensed preparers who do the right thing. Unfortunately, a few reflect negatively on the entire tax preparer community, and those individuals should not be allowed to practice as tax preparers. We support House File 1756 and the Department's efforts to add additional protection for individuals who need assistance and try to comply with the sometimes very hard to understand and often difficult to interpret tax law. This bill will give the department additional tools to address the problem that's only going to continue to grow as attempts to steal financial information and personal identities increases and the filing of fraudulent tax returns increases. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Any questions from members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Marquardt, I'm very supportive of your proposal. I'm looking on page 11. On line 11.16, I'm asking staff to do some quick research. Here you only preclude someone from being these tax preparers if they've been convicted of an identity theft crime or similar statute. That I assume means a statute from another state. Usually there's a whole group of types of crimes that we exclude folks from, and I'm looking to see if maybe there's just a subsection in the statute that we could reference. I'm hoping that maybe we could work together between now and then to actually exclude all the folks who've been convicted of identity type, theft type statutes or theft or fraud. I assume that's what you intended to get at with that section.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, that's exactly right. I mean, identity fraud is a huge issue right now, and that is what we're trying to. So I'm willing to work with whatever we need to do to make sure that part is taken care of.
Mr. Chair, are you okay with that?
What's that?
Mr. Chair, are you okay with us figuring out what section of statute we should just reference to encompass all of those types of similar crimes?
Yes, if you two are in agreement, fine with me. Any public testimony? No more questions here. The chair will renew his motion on House File 1754 to be referred to taxes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Representative Marquardt.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you so much.
Okay. Representative Slocum, House File 1769. Chair will move House File 1769 to be referred to taxes. Amendments. Representative Slocum, if you would like, I will move your A1 amendment to your bill. Chair moves the A1 amendment to House File 1769 to get in the order the author would like. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, Representative Slocum, to your amended bill, House File 1769.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, I miss this committee. I really do, just to start things off. And I miss you, Chair Cornish, in particular. But this was always one of my favorite committees. And yeah. So, anyway, getting down to business. This is a bill that you saw last year. It was in the tax bill that didn't go, so we're doing it again. It's probably one of the more interesting bills you're going to see this year because it's about zappers. You may say to yourself, now, what is this person talking about, zappers? Zappers are the slang name, basically, for an apparatus that is commonly sold by the people that sell the computers that add up your totals when you're at a restaurant or a retail venue. And then what a zapper does is it zaps some of the cost so that the person who owns the business is evading some taxes. So this is a real very Minnesota taxpayer-friendly bill because people who don't pay their taxes should be called to order. In Minnesota currently, there are no imposed penalties for sale or possession of sales zappers, the sales suppression devices. This limitation makes it difficult for the Department of Revenue to pursue businesses and individuals that do not transmit to the state all the sales tax they have collected to customers. The technology has allowed this skimming to become fast, easy, and difficult to detect. Therefore, this bill. This bill imposes penalties for the design, development, sale, possession, or use of computer software that alters or creates fraudulent accounting records. And that is pretty much it. I have a testifier. Representative Paul Cummings. No. Paul Cummings from the Department of Revenue.
Mr. Cummings, I'll introduce yourself and begin.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to come and present this bill today. This proposal amends Minnesota Statute 289A to make it unlawful for a person to sell, purchase, manufacture, install, transfer, possess, develop an automated sales suppression device, zapper, phantomware, or similar device in the state and provides civil and criminal penalties. This tax evasion software is sold factory installed on point-of-sale machines or cash registered, sold separately, and is even offered as a cloud-based service. This provision also amends Minnesota Statute 609 to provide that these devices are contraband and must summarily be forfeited upon conviction. So what is a sales suppression device, sometimes called a zapper? It is a computer function that facilitates tax evasion. The sales suppression can be facilitated through flash drives, CDs, or through the Internet. It allows businesses to avoid remitting sales and income tax on deleted or reduced receipts. In these cases, business retains sales tax collected from their customers. In other states, we have found that businesses with customers that pay for more of their transactions in cash are the highest users of the software. In these situations, some businesses create two sets of books while remove other sales data from all records. In a 2009 New York sting operation, 22 of 23 sales selling at point-of-sale systems to a retailer offered the retailer sales suppression devices, software, or services without prompting. In a 12-month period, the Minnesota Department of Revenue completed about 40 audits where we identified an indication of possible sales suppression. These audits resulted in $1.2 million of tax that was collected but not remitted to the state. According to the Tax Research Division of Minnesota Department of Revenue, this proposal by itself would not generate additional revenue for the state. If you go to the third slide in the handout, on page 2 of the handout, you see two different receipts. You see the real receipt on the right that the customer paid for and received, having a total of about $50. And then there's a reprint of that receipt after sale suppression has occurred, and that total has gone down, ensuring that that would have the tax go down by about $2.50. Add that transaction or after transaction, and that is much more money. 24 states have adopted similar legislation, as you can see on the handout. This was based on some model legislation from NCSL. Anecdotally, we have heard from states that have enacted similar legislation similar to this. It is effective in creating a chilling effect on the sale design and use of sales suppression software. This legislation, along with current Minnesota rules that require retailers to keep original sales records, books, and logs, would go a long way to combat this problem of automated sales suppression. As Representative Slocum mentioned, this language was included in the tax bill that was passed but not enacted at the end of last session. Provisions were changed in the process of getting this to this place through conference committee last year. For instance, in order to receive a penalty, it must be knowing behavior, so people cannot unknowingly use software and then be charged with a felony. So that is no longer part of the bill. So what you see before it is a compromise. It is sort of come back from the NCSL model legislation. And, Mr. Chair, as I close, I want to be clear that the vast majority of Minnesota retailers are doing the right thing. They're reporting and remitting the right amount of tax based on actual transactions. So this is an exception, and this is to deal with those exceptions. I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to come before this committee today, Mr. Chair, and the next stop for this committee is tax committee.
Okay, thank you very much. Members, keep in mind the bill is here because of the penalties, and it already passed once, didn't it, last year? Or did you said it was before us?
Well, last year, yeah, but...
Right.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do remember this bill last time. And last time I asked the testifier from Revenue how pervasive it was, and I appreciate that you put that into your testimony this time. You had said that you had 40 audits, but you didn't say exactly out of those 40 audits how many you actually came across something that was like this. I mean, I look at these receipts, and, you know, I actually used to work at a CPA firm and help people out when they had sales tax audits, so I'm a bit familiar with receipts and how they should look. But just a layperson could look at these receipts and say, oh, there's something amiss here. You know, it's substantially reduced. So out of those 40 audits, you didn't really say, like, how many were suspect. I think you said something about $1.5 million was collected. So can you just talk to us a little bit more about how pervasive this is and how this legislation would impede and maybe prevent some of this from actually happening?
Mr. Cummings, if you could get a short analysis, please.
Mr. Chair, that 40 was what we believe to have used sales suppression software. There's a number that higher for the number of audits that may have suppressed receipts or suppressed sales, but that is not the number that we believe have used this type of software. We think that 40 number is reflective of the number that have used some sort of a sales suppression type of mechanism. And I think... Was there one last question, Ms. O'Neill, that I think I might have missed?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I wanted to know the scope, and so you had said 40 audits were suspect out of how many, so we can get a sense as to how many.
Sure, coming.
I think out of the items, I think it was 80 to 90 audits that we had looked at in terms of some sort of suppression of sales. 40 was the number in which we thought used this device. And then, Mr. Chair, I want to be clear that this would not apply to all of those cases necessarily. This deals with the narrower scope of knowing behavior, and there are different types of, you know, criteria that this must have.
Just one last quick question. Just how many audits? So out of total audits, and you had 80 that were suspect and 40 that you suspected of this happening, but out of the total, how many audits were done in that year?
How many total sales tax audits were done in a 12-month period? I don't know, but I can give that to the committee. I can give that to Mr. Falou and Ms. O'Neill.
Okay. Representative Lucero, Considine, and Pinto.
Thank you, Madam, Mr. Chair, and to the bill author, a couple questions here. So in regards to the software, and there's a long list here, sells, purchases, installs, transfers, possesses, develops, manufactures, accesses, et cetera. And so when it comes to technology or software, many times there is a dual purpose. And so when I heard you say that some manufacturers embed randomizing software into the operating system of the particular technology, I am potentially concerned. Not being familiar with this, is there any legitimate purpose of this randomizing software that could inadvertently now rope people in or rope anybody in that you don't intend? And I give just a few examples when it comes to, again, software technology. Password crackers. One might initially think that password crackers to compromise a password can only be bad, but that software does have very legitimate good purposes as well. Wireless signal suppressors that would interfere with Wi-Fi or cell phones, etc. One initially might think those are only illegitimate, but they can serve and are used for legitimate purposes. So, again, my question is, is there any legitimate use for the particular software that you're randomizing that you're discussing?
Whoever would like to answer that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lucero, I'm no expert on IT. I have to phone a friend.
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is no other reason for the software other than sales suppression for the use of tax evasion, and it is actually sold and marketed that way. That is what we found with the New York sting, that it's sales and marketed to the city. We can have you pay less to New York State because of this. So that's the way it's marketed.
There you go. And one quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Then, not being one who's familiar at all with tax evasion, et cetera, when it comes to the criminal penalty, I see here that the penalty is felony with 5 years, up to 5 years imprisonment or $10,000 fine. Is that commensurate with other type of tax evasion, et cetera, et cetera?
Mr. Cummings?
Yes. When we reviewed our other types of tax felonies, this was in line with that. We also, it was in line with other types of felonies that came before these committees.
Okay, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do you purchase software, have it installed, and then unknowingly use it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Oh, Mr. Gomez.
This is for knowing behavior. But what one of the concerns was, there had been some model legislation passed in some states that had unknowing behavior be either a felony or a gross misdemeanor. But a cashier would be a person who could unknowingly use a sales suppression device. And so we don't, so this law, and it was made sure that no one who would unknowingly use this would be caught up in this. So like a cashier would be a person that could use the software.
Representative Considine.
Okay, so thank you. You're just talking about employees then that didn't buy it, didn't install it. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question is going to be Representative Lucero's about legitimacy. My understanding is that there is no other legitimate purpose for the software and the device. I guess I'm still concerned about how this is phrased. It's phrased too broadly that anybody who's in possession of one of these devices or software for any reason at all, as long as they know that it's capable of that, would be criminalized. So I'm comparing like possession of shoplifting gear. If there's a device that's designed to have an unauthorized removal, basically for shoplifting, you're still only convicted of that or can only be charged with that if you have it in your possession with the intent to use it to shoplift. I guess I'd be concerned the way this is written and would just encourage you to continue to look at it as it moves forward. Professor at the university, law enforcement who is in possession of this device and knows that it's capable of being used would in fact be captured by this. I might encourage you just to look at some of those other similar crimes where something maybe has no other legitimate use, and yet there still has to be a connection with the intent to use it in that way. I encourage you to look at that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Public testimony. Mr. Neumeister? I guess he's not here. Okay. Member questions? If none,
Mr. Chair, we'll work with Representative Pinto and the Chair.
Very shortly. What did you say? What was your question?
Mr. Chair, we'll work with Representative Pinto and the Chair on his suggestion.
Oh, okay. I thought there was a question. I'm sorry. All right. The Chair will renew his motion for House File 1769 as amended, be referred to taxes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion carried. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative, let's see, this is my bill. I'll move my own bill, House File 1581, to be referred to the General Register and call up Lieutenant Colonel Greg Salo from DNR Enforcement. If you can just wait, Rich and Mr. Neumeister, and we'll give you like a minute in the end here. Members, House File 1581 is a gross over limits bill. This was passed last year by these committees and through the House, I believe. And however, it was not passed by both the House and the Senate or signed. But was it passed in the Senate, too?
Yes.
Yeah, it was in House Senate, but it just never made it to the governor then. What this is a what exactly what it says, gross over limits of fish and game. This isn't the extra perch miscounted in the bucket or a duck that might have been under a bag you didn't see. This is gross over limits. And it's pretty much identical last year's bill with, I think, a change that Lieutenant Colonel Sale will discuss. So, Lieutenant Colonel, could you go ahead and give your testimony?
Sure. For the record, my name is Greg Sale. I work for the Division of Enforcement with the DNR. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, for having me. What your House File 1581 is really three parts. The first part is Section 1 and Section 2, which just gives some clarity to county prosecutors' responsibilities for prosecuting game and fish violations. And then the bigger piece is also there, we have a civil forfeiture process that's part of it that was questionable in the past of whether or not it fell underneath the county prosecutors. This just clarifies that it does. The purpose for clarifying this is we work across the entire state and certain we like the consistency of county prosecutors instead of municipalities that hire out attorneys to do their prosecution. So this provides clarity, doesn't change a whole lot. We did build in or copied right out of the DUI forfeiture law the 30% for civil forfeitures. 30% of the proceeds of that sale can go back to the county prosecutors for their work in doing it. Section 3 is kind of stands by itself. Now, this is new language this year. This was not heard last year. And this is another kind of just adds clarity to the statute saying any violations of game and fish laws is defaults to a misdemeanor if it's not noted in statute. And then the final piece is sections 4, 5, and 6, which talks about the gross over limits, which is, it can be confusing to talk about, so I'm going to sum it up the best way I can. Right now we have kind of a two-tier system with game and fish violations and revocations, and this is all relates to revocations. So every animal in the state of Minnesota is assigned a value. Deer are $500, walleyes are $30, wolves are $400. We call that the restitution value. If you take one of those animals illegally, you have to pay the state back that restitution value. So the way it is right now, a restitution value of that's greater than $500 results in a three-year license revocation. And a restitution value over $5,000 results in a five-year license revocation. What we're doing is we're ratcheting that down fairly tight and making a three-tier system where we have a three-year revocation, a five-year revocation, and then for the worst of the worst, we have a 10-year revocation. And if you have the easiest sheet to look at instead of reading through the actual language on the bill is in the fact sheet on the back page. It breaks it down into a kind of a boxy piece of information, but that gives a very clear outlook on this. And this was a governor's initiative for stiffer penalties on the poaching cases that shock the conscience, where you have thousands and thousands of illegally harvested animals. This is what we're going after. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Members, questions? No testimony from the public. Okay, if without any questions from members or the public, the chair would renew his motion for House File 1581. to be referred to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members.
Representative Johnson, House File 33. You may move your own bill once you get there, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, this is going to government op.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move a motion that House File 33 be passed and referred to government operations.
Okay, the bill is before us, Representative Johnson. Go ahead with your testimony.
This bill deals with the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, which was by statute started in 1978. And over the years, it has worked very well. It was designed to get more evenly sentenced, doing the sentences more evenly across the state. There's still some issues we need to work out with some of the disparities in the sentences, but they're still continuing their work on that. In 2016, we had an issue where the sentencing guidelines developed the new policy on the drug offenses. Some people said it went too far. Some people said it didn't go far enough. The problem was the legislature had no say in that. If we ended up, Representative Cornishaw sponsored a bill and worked with all the groups to actually bring a legislation to change that. Currently, the way the law reads is that unless we say no, whatever the sentencing guideline says is law. They act as law. There's 11 members of that commission. 6 members make a quorum. 4 members can pass major changes to our sentences. That's done in the state of Minnesota. I think that is wrong. It's no different than the 16 member of this committee getting together with only 9 of us here, 5 of us passing a bill, and it bypasses the floor and immediately goes into law. In 1978, it might have been a good idea, but I believe that anytime we look at changing the sentences, it should be at least 68 members of the House of Representatives saying yes. It should be 34 senators saying yes. And it should be a governor signing that bill. Because this definitely does affect the citizens of the state, not only the individuals that are charged with the crime. It also affects the victims. Yes, when in 2016, when they did the drug offense issue, did some changes need to be made? Absolutely. And I advocated for some of those changes, as long as the chair here also did on some of the weight limits that we had on the sentences that did need to change. But the wholesale changes, I believe, were out of line. Because what it did is just push the people being incarcerated from the state system, whether we have services for them for drug addiction and other things and other training, to the county system, which they have no support system whatsoever. And it's a burden on our counties. So what this bill does is says that any changes they make lowering sentences, it's a recommendation to the legislature, and we have to say yes or no. If we say yes, it goes through. If we say no, it doesn't. And it makes... So we have to have 68, 34, and 1 instead. And those are great numbers that Chair Davis uses, and I really like them. So it's 68, 34, and 1, and not 6 and 4. And that's the gist of this bill. But I'm open for any questions.
Did you have any other testifiers to support?
I do not have any other testifiers.
For for support of your bill, and one of the reasons we brought this here and are advancing it, we realized how the Sentencing Guidelines Commission was sent up and its purpose, which was meant to be a good one. The problem is, in the last couple of months, I have been taking pictures of articles in newspapers and sending them to our members, and at least on the GOP side, of one case after the other of somebody that is caught on the street, and without any exaggeration, six felony convictions, seven felony convictions. One yesterday, I think, was listed as had a terrible record, I think it said in the paper, with multiple felony violations for the shooting on the ramp. Just one after another, and the public is calling me saying, what has gone wrong with our system? Because it's just these people invariably, and if the people in the community, you folks in the seats, watch and go over the news articles, it's almost inevitable, that the next serious crime that you see reported in the paper is killing, the person will have multiple felony convictions and are still out in the street. And I'm talking about put in prison 2005 and get out in 2007, convicted, get out 2 years later, 3 years later, boom, boom, boom. It seems like you get three or four freebies. And so that's the reason that I encouraged and worked with Representative Johnson on this bill, is to see if we can bring some reality to the sentencing. It seems like Representative Johnson and I are talking about how anxious we are all of a sudden to reduce the prison population, even though we're only second in per capita prisons. And so that's one of the reasons in the whole the next issue we get into in the next bill will continue on this same vein. But that's just some of my thoughts, and we're naturally entertained. I don't want to give the only comments here. We'll take them from all of our members here, but what their interest is. But Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I did was going to talk about one other issue. Today is domestic abuse day at the Capitol here, trying to stop domestic abuse. I'm not sure how many members are aware, but last June, Sentencing Guidelines Commission started training our probation officers in their pre-sentence investigations to treat before the change in the law passed the drug convictions under the new statutes. The problem with that is that affects a lot of different crimes, including domestic abuse. And that's one issue that I was concerned about, because it affects the sentences. It could change from a gross misdemeanor, a domestic abuse charge in a strangulation case, and it could actually change because of what would have been a felony offense by changing, going back and using the new drug conviction levels as the prior convictions level. It might not be a felony conviction anymore. And we also have a number of individuals that, because they were going back on the sentences, might have had those convictions, and they could have changed their conviction. I have no idea how many people that are currently in prison or on probation would have gone back into the court systems to have their sentences changed. So in June they were starting to train their probation officers to go backwards, even though during the negotiations for the bill that was passed, that was taken out. It wasn't until December, I believe it was 27th or 28th, they had a public hearing to talk about it. So it makes me really wonder if they're doing things properly, and if we need to have a little more oversight of that commission. Fortunately, I believe it was a 6-7 vote that did not go in. But they're having a vote on doing something that they're doing the training for 6 months prior. It really makes me wonder what's going on, and I believe it's our duty to protect the citizens of this state, because this is a good state. Most of our sentences are on paper and not in prison. But I think it's something that we need to look at and do our responsibility to protect the citizens of Minnesota.
Okay, you've got a testifier, but before we get to your testifier, or not yours, but somebody from the community there, Representative Dean has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I find this fascinating presentation of this bill. I understand what the bill does, and I would contend that in 2016, we did have a say. We could have said no. And we chose not to say no. We chose to stay silent on the recommendations of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And, you know, you talked about the importance of having folks on the inside where they have access to chemical dependency treatment and mental health treatment, but we willfully underfund those programs within our Department of Corrections. So I mean, if you're proposing that we now begin to fund it at the appropriate levels, I would love to see that bill come forward. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission worked in the way that you're speaking, because in December when they took the vote about making retroactive changes to the guidelines that had went into effect in 16, which, by the way, evidence shows that retroactive changes versus changes moving forward have virtually no impact on the amount of recidivism as a result of those retroactive changes. So the system does work. You may not like it, but it does work. And I think that if we're going to go back and change it, we need to think long and hard about what that means. Because quite frankly, you referenced that, you know, we're unique in the country in that we have a lot of people serving their time out in the community. And I would contend that part of the reason why that is because of our sentencing guidelines and how we're able to sort of filter through those individuals that we're mad at because they've committed crimes versus those individuals that we're fearful of because they committed the crime. So I guess I'm speaking against this bill even before we hear all the final testimonies. I think the system's working, and I think we should continue with it moving forward.
Okay, Kelly Mitchell, Executive Director of the Robina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice. Representative Johnson, a short comment?
I'm just wondering how many members knew about that December 28th, I believe it was December 28th, public hearing. We had one member besides myself that knew about it. But I would think if they're having a public meeting like that, the Public Safety Committee should know about it.
Ma'am, go ahead and introduce yourself and begin.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Kelly Mitchell, and I'm the Executive Director of the Robina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice at the University of Minnesota Law School. Prior to that, I served as the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and I'm also currently serving my third year as President of the National Association of Sentencing Commissions. I'm here to testify against this bill. Minnesota was the first state to enact sentencing guidelines, and currently the guidelines are viewed as a model both for other states in America and internationally. The stability and the predictability that the sentencing guidelines have engendered within the Minnesota criminal justice system have allowed our state to prioritize its prison resources for those who commit the most serious offenses or who have the most extensive criminal records. And as a result, we've consistently had one of the lowest incarceration rates in the nation, and we've avoided the kind of rapid escalation in prison populations and dangerous overcrowding issues that have often occurred in other states. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission was established as an independent agency comprising representation from all of the stakeholders in the criminal justice system. They meet on a monthly basis, and their role is to serve as a state source of expertise on sentencing policy and practice. Not only do they stay up to date on the current state of the law, but they also actually look at how sentencing plays out within the courts to determine how sentencing policies are being applied at the case level. The commission reviews and amends the guidelines on an annual basis, and all of those amendments are provided to the legislature annually in the commission's annual report. If the legislature is dissatisfied with any of those changes, it can enact a law. The law can take any action deemed appropriate by the legislature, including blocking a change from taking effect, delaying the effective date of that change, directing the commission to take it back and do more work on that issue, or modifying the proposal directly. This oversight is referred to as a legislative override. The commission develops proposals, and if the legislature takes no action, those changes take effect. But if the legislature so chooses, it can override that proposal in any of those ways I just mentioned. Minnesota is one of eight jurisdictions in the nation that utilize this legislative override process. The other jurisdictions are Alabama, Arkansas, Washington, D.C., Pennsylvania, Utah, Virginia, and the federal government. Like Minnesota, the guidelines in all of these jurisdictions are freestanding. They're not enacted into statute. Seven states require affirmative legislative approval, and five of those states, Kansas, Michigan, North Carolina, Ohio, and Washington, they actually enact their sentencing guidelines into law. So as a natural outcome, every single change to their guidelines has to work through the legislative process. So that's really why they have the approval model. Oregon is the sixth state, and their guidelines are developed through the administrative rulemaking process, but the legislature must approve any changes during the session or the rules are repealed. The seventh state is Alabama, and you might have noticed that I mentioned that also as an override state, and that's because that state takes both approaches. Originally, Alabama's guidelines were entirely voluntary, but faced with rising prison population and costs, the state needed to take steps to control the influx of its population. So one change that they made was that the guidelines for all nonviolent offenses were made to be presumptive, meaning the judges had to utilize the guidelines in those cases unless there was a good case for departure. And then violent crimes remained voluntary. When they made that change, the presumptive guidelines were changed so that they would be subject to legislative override, and the voluntary guidelines remained in the legislative approval model. The presumptive, what this did for Alabama was it allowed them to move the state forward with sentencing reform. Since the nonviolent offenses made up the larger portion of their prison population, moving those changes over to the Sentencing Commission allowed them to depoliticize that process and actually make progress in their sentencing reform. But they still had the ability to override any changes that they didn't agree with. There's a few benefits of the legislative override approach. First, because the Commission has been tasked with developing sentencing law and policy expertise, the legislature can rely upon that expertise. It can rely on the Commission to conduct research and to vet controversial issues through public hearings, which they do. All of this reduces the amount of time the legislature has to spend on these issues, whereas requiring legislative approval would require that work instead shift to the legislature. The legislative override approach allows the legislature to focus only on the sentencing policy issues that are the most concerning to it and doesn't clog up the session with the regular housekeeping business of the commission. Despite that, the legislature, if at any point disagrees with any aspect of the commission's work, it can choose to exercise its override authority. There have been a few recent examples of this exercise of authority. We already heard that last year the legislature engaged in a discussion about the controlled substance amendments, modified the proposals by the commission, and also changed other laws in addition to that. In 2010, the legislature delayed the effective date by 1 year of proposed changes to move prostitution and sex trafficking offenses from the standard grid to the sex offender grid. And in 2006, when the sex offender grid was presented to the legislature for the first time, the legislature modified the rankings of a few offenses before it went into effect. To sum up, the Minnesota sentencing guidelines have been in operation for over 30 years. The legislative override has been a feature of the guidelines since their inception. Given the long and established history of the guidelines and of the relationship between the commission and the legislature, There's no reason to change the system to require affirmative legislative approval. The system is working as it was designed to. It isn't broken, and so I urge you not to fix it.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson. I understand what you're trying to do, and I think we do need to have some of these discussions. My concern is that we look at a more of a comprehensive situation so that we are adequately funding the programs for rehabilitation, for reform, for criminal thinking, to provide the services that the offenders need so that we really do make changes in behavior and the outcomes. That's, I think, where we really fall short, so that we need to have that kind of better impact. And I would like to see a bigger, more comprehensive approach, realizing that it's going to cost money to put people into prison, but it costs money when they recidivate as well. So I think we need to invest in advance.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, I agree that it costs money. The problem with what was done with the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, with their ruling, and even with the compromise that was made in 2016, it did the opposite. Because these people that are now going into the county jails have no programs available. They were available in the state system, but they're not available in the county system. I do have a bill that's trying to help with that funding. I'm hoping to get a hearing on it. But right now, there is nothing for them, and that's even worse. One thing the Sentencing Guidelines Commission do is not only look at the sentences and make sure they're done fairly, make sure it's appropriate for the crime, but also have to look at what's the best interest and the safety of the public. And sometimes I wonder if they're forgetting that part.
Members, just be reminded that we're not talking about decreasing funding. We're not talking about getting rid of their. We're not talking about putting people in prison. This bill doesn't address that. What we're trying to do is bring attention to the fact with this bill and the next one, just trying to find out what's happening out there, why the suspect the other day raped and sodomized a 7-year-old girl time after time over a period of years, and he's getting out in 2019. We just like to raise those type of questions. The people with the terrible criminal histories that are getting out for domestic abuse, rape, sodomy, all these terrible crimes that's been in the papers that you've seen. So that's all we're trying to do here, is find out what's happening out there in the community and let the legislature take a closer look. So we realize there's a purpose for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and we're not trying to get rid of it. We just want to examine it a little closer. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson, I did want to thank you for acknowledging that today is the day that the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women is trying to bring attention to domestic violence issues in our community. So I thank you for acknowledging that. Just wanted to clarify, though, that nothing the Sentencing Guidelines Commission does affects whether we can charge domestic violence crimes as felonies or misdemeanors or gross misdemeanors. That doesn't have – none of the recent changes have impacted the ability to hold people accountable in that way. I mean, I'm assuming maybe you were referring to the overall point system and – but I just wanted to clarify, I think, for the public, too, that nothing the Sentencing Guidelines Commission has done affects our ability to charge people with felony domestic violence offenses. So I just, if you could just clarify if that's what you were referring to.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dr. Finn. In the domestic abuse statute, one of the enhancements is prior felony drug conviction. And that can enhance during the pre-sentence investigation. And it can change it whether somebody would end up as a felon, for on a felony conviction, whether or a gross misdemeanor, is my understanding.
Just to clarify, it's the enhancement you're talking about is not the qualified domestic violence related offenses, which is that's what helped us get from a misdemeanor, a gross misdemeanor, to a felony. That's in the way that they calculate the points after somebody's already been charged. So just to clarify that those are two separate types of enhancements.
Okay, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, as the only legislator ever to attend a sentencing guideline committee, I can assure you that they are thinking of the public safety in their discussions. I've heard it. And I'd also encourage the rest of you to go to some of their meetings. This bill, frankly, is micromanaging something that we have in place. But the worst part of it is that the way this was set up was specifically so there wouldn't be knee-jerk reactions in the legislature to some horrendous thing without some sort of review. That this bill will reverse that. The other thing is it will politicize what's going on. Whoever has the majority at that time will be able to change the rules. And I think both of those things are really a bad idea. So I don't think I can support this. We have a system that has worked for 30-some years. We do have oversight. We can stop anything they do. We had a robust discussion last time about what the sentencing guidelines proposed, and I thought that Representative Cornish's amendment fixed the one thing that I had a qualm about, and we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Constantine. Just to assure you that it's not a knee-jerk reaction, my members, I think, can tell you that for the past number of years, I've been cutting pieces out of the paper and sending them emails, so much to the point where one person said, I'm having to create a special file on my computer just for your articles. And I only cut out the egregious one where I'm thinking, and what in the world went on? And so that's one of the reasons that it's here. Not a knee-jerk reaction. It's just years and years of this happening. So, and I agree that it, we are managing and jumping in, and if you want to call it micromanaging, bring it in for a microscopic look if we can. Let's see. We have any other testifiers? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that these situations involving these really awful situations the Chair is describing, the group that would be best positioned to look into those situations, figure out was it a departure by a judge that shouldn't have happened, was it a flaw in the guidelines, a flaw in the law, whatever it is, would be a group consisting of prosecutors, cops, probation officers, public defenders, judges, like the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. So I'd certainly encourage sending those articles to that commission. In my experience as a prosecutor, we're talking, as the testifier said, deep expertise into what is a pretty complicated system, a system that can always be improved like any system. But we want people to be spending that kind of time and effort, and people with that kind of background. When I look at a couple people that I know on this commission, I mean, this is a, you know, there's some real tough-as-nails people here. On the law enforcement side and the other side as well. Again, things can be improved all the way along. The fact is that the way the system works right now is that when we choose to act 6434-1, 6834-1, we have full power. As a testifier said, we can do anything with the system that we want. The situation we're really describing here is when we don't act, which we know sometimes happens, right? There's a lot of pressure to get a bonding bill, but we don't pass one, or a tax bill, or things happen. Things don't pass. And if they don't, the question is, should the entire system wait for us to not have acted? As the testifier said, a lot of what goes on is a lot of cleanup stuff. And if the Guidelines Commission has to wait and the criminal justice has to wait for us to act, it just seems to me that in this one place, sort of, should we have a pocket veto, which is essentially what this is, we don't act and it doesn't happen. If I'm thinking about that right, you understand what I'm saying? Or do we want to say, look, if we act, of course we have control over things and we continue to. It's just that if we don't act in that situation, does the system wait for us, or does this group of experts that has a lot of expertise on this we've looked into Does this proposal they have, does that move forward? And I want to point out, there's a full 6.5 months after they submit it to us, the entire legislative session. We got plenty of time to look at anything that they do and make any kind of action we want. But if we don't, if we choose not to collectively, should these experts be allowed to move forward? And we can always change it at a later time, too. So I have great concerns about what would happen with the system. And it seems to me if we have concerns about specific situations, as the chair has identified, let's dive into those situations but not make this kind of change. Thank you.
Any other testifiers? No questions? All right. Representative Pinoy, I appreciate your comments, and just closing comment from me is that everybody's blaming everybody right now for these criminals getting free. When I call a judge, the judge tells me, well, we usually okay after the pre-sentence investigation. If the defense and the county attorney bring it to me, pretty much all the time the judges follow that. They can reject some. Well, then when I talk to a county attorney in my area, they say that they are limited what they can do. The reason why they didn't sentence him so tough was because the guidelines don't allow them to. And once you begin, you go back to the judge and you say, well, why wasn't this person registered? Well, it's not a registrable offense, and I'm limited what I can do. I'd like to do this. And the county attorney tells me, well, I'd like to do this. So I guess this and the other bill is just why we're trying to get a closer look to find out why everybody lays the fault for this violent criminal being on the streets and continuing to commit the crimes. Just want to take a closer look at what's going on out there. So we're not trying to get rid of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. So, okay, any other questions? Chair will, or no, Representative Johnson, you can move your own bill.
There's a couple final comments. Sentencing guidelines overall, since their conception, has done very well. There is some issues. The question that I have, are we not doing our responsibility? As we look at, we are the ones that are supposed to be doing this. And we've ceded that authority to somebody else. And it's just, should we take a look at it? If they make their recommendations, we have all these agency bills, or department bills that we do all the time, and just... they send it over and we send it through. Unless we find a problem, we deal with that specific problem. I don't see anything changing in that. Generally, their recommendations are going to go through, but once in a while, there's some that we need to take a closer look at. And depending, and I know with the issue last session, Chair Cornish worked tirelessly trying to resolve that issue. And a lot of times, we don't have a lot of time. Session started this year, January 3rd. Just, what was it, 9 weeks ago, and our deadline is Friday. We don't have 6-8 months to deal with it. We have a very short time to deal with it. So that's why I think it's something that this is something we need to look at and we need to move forward. And with that, Chair, I renew my motion.
Okay, Representative Johnson renews his motion for House File 33 to be referred to Government Operations. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay, motion carried. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Grosso, House File 1572. Members, it looks like it would be unbelievable if we could get done with this by noon. If we don't, just make the announcement again. It's 5 o'clock at 400 South. And members, when you hear me saying short answer, short questions, the only reason I'm doing that is that we've got like 20-some bills to hear before deadline. They're DFL bills and GOP bills. And it's really tough if we don't make deadline to get Rules Committee to bring it back up. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Considine.
It would appear that the representative is once again flouting the traditions of the committee.
Well, now you have to make up for it twice.
I'm trying to protect you from yourself.
Representative Grosso, you move your bill. It looks like it's going to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I move that this bill be laid over for possible inclusion on the omnibus.
Okay, Representative Gross will begin.
Mr. Chair and Committee, HF 1572 is a bill that eliminates stays of adjudication and stays of imposition in criminal conduct cases. Sex offenders required to serve lifetime conditional release or probation, intensive probation for sex offenders established child pornography, penalties increased, and mandatory minimum sentences created, and Sentencing Guidelines Commission directed to modify the sex offender grid. Yeah, Mr. Chair and Committee, I know that I'd like to start by saying that I believe that everyone here today has nothing but the best interest and safety of our children in our communities, in their hearts and minds. With that being said, I also believe that no one here condones child pornography or child exploitation. Mr. Chair and Committee, I'm here today on behalf of the victims of criminal sexual conduct, and more specifically for the children victims. It was brought to my attention from a police chief in my district that a case that he was involved with, an adult male that was perpetrating on children. And one of the shocking things that he discovered was during sentencing, the option to receive a stay of imposition was one thing that could be on the table for this perpetrator. And so early in December, about mid-December, he brought it to my attention and asked that once I get sworn in, that I try to do something, to look into doing something about this to eliminate stays of imposition. And so working with House Research, we put together this bill. I'd like to play a short video for the members in committee right now, if I may.
Tonight, Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton is responding to a Care 11 investigation. That investigation exposed sex offenders whose crimes have been kept secret from the public. A report that one prosecutor labeled an insane benefit for a child predator is not only getting a response, but also demand for reform. Care 11 investigative reporter A.J. Legault has the story.
I think it's wrong.
What Governor Mark Dayton calls wrong is admitted sex offenders like Eugene Finch having serious predatory crimes against children masked by Minnesota's legal system.
I don't think they should be, and I was shocked to see the report, and I'm working with legislators who share that concern.
When things like this are just wiped under the rug, it's terrible.
That's the mother of an 11-year-old Ramsey County girl molested by Finch. The family had virtually no way to know their landlord had committed a similar crime with a young girl in Carlton County 2 years prior.
I feel like I should have known. I feel like this whole thing could have been prevented.
In the 2014 Carlton case, 45-year-old Finch got busted for repeatedly having sex with a 13-year-old girl in his Hummer SUV. He got what's called a stay of adjudication. That means he admitted he's guilty, but instead of prison, he got probation. But that's not all. The stay meant that if he successfully completed probation, a judge agreed his case would be dismissed with no conviction on his record.
They basically slapped his hand and let him go off.
To further shield Finch while on probation, no information about that charge could be found in the state's public online criminal court database. Unless someone physically went to the courthouse to search, the public had no real way of knowing the man living across the street from a playground and babysitting children was a threat.
The public deserves the right to know.
The governor now says Minnesota needs to tighten the parameters of when stays of adjudication can be used.
To prevent judges and county attorneys from exercising their lawful discretion in ways that clearly violate the public interest.
This appears to be the rare bipartisan call to action, as the Republican head of the House Public Safety Committee also told me today that legislation is now being drafted to address this legal loophole.
Julie. Great reporting, and I know you'll follow.
Looking at child pornography, does it give you a sexual gratification? It did a while ago.
The voice on the recordings, never heard publicly until now, is Jacob Kim. It was 2012, as investigators interrogated him here in his living room about videos of child sexual abuse.
Did you share any of the clips with anybody, send anybody?
I probably did.
Okay, did you receive any from other people?
No.
Court records detail graphic videos found on his computer, including of children being raped. Very young children.
How old do you think they are, roughly?
I don't want to do that.
You guess 5, 6, 7?
I suppose. Is there an age that you consider too young? I was wondering for you. Under six.
The admitted pedophile was convicted in 2013 of possession of child pornography and sentenced to 120 days in the local jail and probation. Not a single day in state prison. But now, the newly released recordings raise the question, did those old interviews foreshadow what was about to happen while he was still out on probation?
Authorities are searching for a missing 5-year-old girl.
The search for the missing girl was launched when her babysitter, Melissa Norby, was found dead, arms bound, in her burned-out home. Attention soon focused on Ken, who was dating the babysitter. Investigators found text messages indicating he plotted to acquire the girl for the purpose of sexually assaulting her. They tracked his cell phone signal to a remote location where they found the girl, assaulted and bound in duct tape.
She's safe and alive.
So far, no charges have been filed in the babysitter's death, but Ken is awaiting trial, accused of kidnapping and sexual assault, something the 2012 tapes suggest he may have been fantasizing about years earlier.
You know that these children that you watched in these clips were, say, under the age of 10.
In fact, at one point, Ken claimed the reason he watched the child rape videos was to relieve the urge to act out himself.
I used to look at it, I guess, as to relieve the want to do.
Sentences like the original one that Ken received a few months in a local jail as opposed to state prison are among the reasons some state lawmakers want to toughen Minnesota's child pornography and other sex crimes laws, which critics describe as among the weakest in the entire country.
Here in Minnesota, we have some of the weakest?
We do, as far as policies. And our Sentencing Guidelines Commission very often calls for probation for many of these crimes. We actually found when we looked at even child rape and sex assault, 65% of the time the offenders never go to prison.
That it?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead with your testimony if the movie's done.
Mr. Chair and Committee, I've handed out a couple of summaries from reports, that one coming from the FBI investigation and another coming from Protect. And Protect is a National Association to Protect Children. I've got the PDF. I've got PDF availability for those. If you want to view the whole report, if you'd like to go through those things, and I encourage each one to do so. A lot of the information in these reports very disturbing, very horrifying that this is going on, and especially in our state, in our own communities. And again, I say, you know, that I know that nobody here. Nobody in this room today advocates child pornography, child exploitation. But something is definitely wrong with our statute, with our system, where stays of adjudication and stays of imposition for such crimes are being allowed. I'd like to have researcher come up and take us through the nuts and bolts of this bill, if I may.
Oh, Mr. Diebel, you can do it from right there.
Okay.
Very good.
Mr. Chair and members, in the interest of time, I will move through this quickly, but please stop me if I'm going too quickly or I'm not covering in enough detail. Sections 1 through 3 are technical amendments. They reflect a repeal of cross-reference. Section 4 begins the substantive provisions of the bill. This would prohibit prosecutors from agreeing to stays of adjudication in criminal sexual conduct cases. Currently, that's permitted if the defense counsel and prosecutor agree, then they can present that to a judge as a means of resolving a criminal sex conduct case. Section 5 would prohibit courts from staying in position of felony criminal sexual conduct cases. So in the case like that, if a sentence was stayed, the imposition was stayed, if the person completed their terms of probation, the offense would not be a felony, it would likely be a misdemeanor on their record, and the offense wouldn't be a felony going forward on their record. Section 6 is another cross-reference that is necessary to reflect a repeal of the language. Sections 7 through 15 are a repeat pattern. In Section 7, for example, it gives practitioners notice and defendants notice that if they're convicted of crime sex conduct 1, that they are subject to lifetime conditional release, or lifetime probation, or intensive probation. In Section 8, if you are convicted, it gives notice that of the earlier provision that stays of adjudication and stays of imposition are prohibited in crime sex conduct 1 cases. Crime sex conduct is broken down into 1 through 5, and so when you move through the sections through 15, it makes those same changes in each of the levels of crime sex conduct. So it gives notice to practitioners that their clients or the defendants could be subject to lifetime conditional release, lifetime probation, lifetime or intensive probation if they're convicted of crime sex conduct, felony level 1 through 5. And that takes us through Section 15 of the bill. Section 16 extends mandatory conditional release to all felony sex offenders who are committed to the Commissioner of Corrections. So if someone receives a sentence from a court for criminal sex conduct and they're sent to prison, upon their release, they will serve whatever portion they have left on supervised release, and after that, they will be on conditional release for the remainder of their life. Section 17 is a new concept, a proposal for a new concept in law. There are persons who are convicted of criminal sex conduct at the felony level who do not have a presumptive commit to the Commissioner of Corrections. Those persons are allowed to serve any incarceration time in the local jail. They're not subject to lifetime conditional release because they're never committed to the Commissioner of Corrections. This provision would make those offenders, those who are convicted of felony criminal sexual conduct and are sentenced to time probation and incarceration in a local jail, subject to lifetime probation. Section 18 is another technical amendment to reflect a repealer in the final section. Section 19 is another new policy proposal in Minnesota. It calls for intensive probation for that group of offenders who are not committed to the Commissioner of Corrections, but who have been convicted of a felony of criminal sexual conduct. This is patterned after our current statute, which provides intensive supervised release. And that only applies to that group of offenders who were sent to the Commissioner of Corrections. So this is a policy that would mirror intensive supervised release for those offenders who are allowed to serve their sentence locally as opposed to in a state prison. And they would be on intensive probation until their executed sentence is satisfied. Section 20
increases the conditional release term for offenders convicted of child pornography offenses. It's not lifetime, but it jumps from five for the. It's not lifetime for first-time offenders, but it does jump from 5 to 10. But if you're a repeat offender, it would impose lifetime conditional release for child pornography offenses. Section 21 proposes a mandatory minimum sentence for child pornography, creation of child pornography, basically participating in sexual performance with a child, and it would be a 6 months minimum, either in prison or in a jail, that you'd have to serve if you're convicted of this offense. If you're a repeat offender or you're a predatory offender at the time you commit the offense, you'd be required to serve a minimum of 12 months either in prison or in jail. Section 22 and 23 increase the statutory maximum penalties for dissemination and possession of child pornography. Section 24 is another mandatory minimum incarceration period, and this applies to the aforementioned dissemination and possession of child pornography offenses, and it mirrors Section 21, where if you are a first-time offender, you would be required to serve a minimum of 6 months of incarceration. If you are a repeat or a predatory offender, you would be required to serve at least 12 months, either in a jail or in prison upon conviction. Section 25 is a directive to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to move child pornography offenses up at least one row in the sex offender grid. So this would produce presumptive prison sentences for certain offenses and would push certain offenses higher so that you would need less criminal history points to receive a prison sentence in certain cases. And that would be, that works in tandem with sections 22 and 23, which increase the statutory maximum for these offenses. So. And then section 26 contains several repealers. The primary substantive repealer is that currently in Crim Sex Conduct 1 through 4, there is a provision that provides for stays of imposition and execution of sentences in interfamilial sex abuse cases. This would repeal that language. And so that legislative endorsement of that practice would be repealed. As the way the bill is drafted now, stays of execution would still be permitted in those cases. It would just be that the guidance provided by the legislature on those specific provisions would no longer be in statute if adopted. And the other repealer is repeals language that provided for something other than lifetime conditional release. Formerly, there was a 10-year conditional release period on most criminal sex offenders. Since it's now lifetime, that language is no longer needed, and it's been repealed in the bill. That concludes my summary.
Thank you, Mr. Deeble. Members, was wondering if we could, for your information, we realized that there would be a fiscal note with this bill. We requested one, and it is in your packet, and this bill will be laid over, so there'll be plenty of time to look at it. Wonder if we could get a couple of the non-governmental or lobbyist people up to testify for us before we break, so that they wouldn't have to come back at 5 o'clock. If the Elizabeth Sullivan and Judy Rangel, and then after they're done, we could probably close out and come back at 5. But go ahead, ma'am, introduce yourself. And
good morning. My name is Elizabeth Sullivan, and I'm the founder and director of Empower Survivors, an organization that supports adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse, education, and prevention when it comes to sexual abuse. I backed the bill today because for many survivors, or most survivors, the perpetrators will not see any time in the jail systems or the prison systems. In the last 4 years, I've spoke to thousands of survivors that were raped as children, and most of them have never had their perps spend any time But yet these people have a lifetime sentence when it comes to having to suffer the consequences of an adult that chose to take that child who was vulnerable and just wanted to be loved and cared for and raped them. This is something that affects them their entire life. You don't just get over it. I know I gotta hurry up. I can't stress how much we need to become more informed as a society on trauma and how this affects the children. I believe that pedophiles and predators do have rights, and I believe they need help. But the person that will take a child and gain their trust and sodomize them and rape them and tell them that if they were to tell anybody, they'd kill their kill their family. Those people do not spend a little bit of time in jail or 15 years in jail and then come out and never have that taste for wanting a child again. That is who they prefer. They want a child at 6 months, 7 years old, 13, 14, 17, because they're easy to manipulate. It's easy to groom them. They groom the children. They groom the adults. They get them. They use them. And that child, the core of who they are, is forever changed. They don't go back to being the child that they were. They are affected the rest of their lives. And when we talk about financial, I know that this may put a burden on financial, but the problem is these kids, they're already into our systems causing, I mean, this goes on to cause the community to have to pay for drug and alcohol treatments. A large majority of our prison inmates were sexually abused. Two-thirds of our alcoholics in AA were sexually abused. This has it affects our medical community because people that are sexually abused end up a lot of times, most of the time, having mental health issues, physical issues, relational issues, problems with authority. The list goes on and on. So for them, it's a lifetime sentence. So I ask you today to please consider passing this bill and really becoming more trauma-informed in understanding the mind of a perpetrator, because they don't think like you and I do. And they have lasting, long-time effect on the children that they choose to rape. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, ma'am. And then are there going to be more of you?
Yes.
Then why don't you take about, watch the clock kind of take about 3 minutes apiece or so, and then we have a session at 12:15. And thank you very much.
Okay. My name is Judy Rangel, and I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. And I like what Elizabeth said, because I heard you talking before about sentencing guidelines and how the prisons are getting full. And I believe also, like she said, that lots of alcoholics, for example, two-thirds of them may have been childhood sexual abuse victims. And so a lot of people who are criminals may have this in their background. And to mask it with alcohol or other crimes, that's maybe a base of this crime. And the problem is that so many people don't talk about it. I feel like I'm unusual because I'm talking about it. It's happened to many, many people, but it's such a horrible, horrible, shameful subject that people don't talk about it. And unless we talk about it and get Aaron's Law passed, for example, so that kids can know what good touch, bad touch is, then we won't, they can find themselves out. But also prosecutors, judges, and ourselves in the community need to talk about it because it's such a big problem. So I hope that this bill, 1572, will pass also. I was just going to say that like County Attorney Tom Kelly, I was reading in some of this literature that he says that the stays of execution are a tool for the prosecutors so they can get something on these perpetrators. But the stays are useless if the perpetrator, if the record is eliminated or erased and there's no, he's not in the database, like in the case you saw on the Channel 11 investigation. So, and also, like, in these sex abuse cases, they are difficult to prosecute because there's often very little physical evidence and other witnesses are corroboration. And statistics show that only 1% of sexual abuse cases are false accusations. So only 1% of people are falsely accused. And this is just 1% of the thousands of cases that are brought to court. Most cases are not brought to court. Most people are loath to talk about this, they were molested. And so by our silence, the perpetrators continue to molest people. And they don't, as you've probably seen in statistics and in TV watching, that they continue to pedophiles continue to perpetrate. They don't stop. You know, they go to, like, Moose Lake. And I worked as a helper for Ramsey County SOS Sexual Offense Services and help with people when they were going to Regents Hospital and getting get a rape kit. And in our training in that Ramsey County thing was excellent because they said they brought in someone from one of the people who works trying to train perpetrators. They said that most of them do not change, and so that's why they need jail time. And the laws in Minnesota are horrific and the worst in the nation. So this, I hope this law will change, and I hope you pass it. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
My name is April Kane. I'm a survivor of sexual abuse and sexual assault. I was sexually abused by my father from a very young age. My first memory is being assaulted by him in my parents' bed. Another early memory is being assaulted by him in a bathtub as he liked to take them with me, and he was a naked adult male. I went down to the laundry room in my building. I lived in an apartment building, and I was allowed to go there as a small child. I should not have been allowed to go there. I was raped and assaulted by a stranger in the laundry room. I came up to my apartment, and my mother understood that I was upset, but I had no vocabulary to describe sexual assault. My mother simply said, "You're no longer allowed down in the laundry room," and it was never mentioned again. Until last week, before I testified in front of the Education Policy Committee for Aaron's Law, which would teach children to speak out if abused, I'm 53 years old. Minnesota is known by Protect.org and in the country as having some of the weakest sentencing for sex offenders in the entire country. It is a severe present crisis. 88% of the people brought up on child porn charges never saw one single day in state prison. Child porn is a crime scene where children are being raped and sodomized. 200 people in Minnesota were given a stay of adjudication, were found guilty of crimes, were not put on the sex offender registry. The registry which came out of the crisis of Jacob Wetterling, it's a slap in the face to all Minnesotans that we have sex offenders and we don't put them on the registry, named after Drew Shadeen, who was killed in Minnesota. But we're letting these criminals be invisible. You can live next door to them, and there's no way to know. The next time another child is abducted, the police can't find them because the predators are invisible. We have to put barriers between these criminals and the children and the victims. We don't need to know the answer to every question. Can we stop recidivism? What will stop it? We have to put the barriers because when the tragedy happens, you cannot undo it. When Drew Shadeen was found stabbed, beaten, with her hands tied behind her back, naked, dead, with a bag tied over her head, you can't take that back. Drew is gone. You can't bring Jacob Wetterling back. But when Danny Heinrich raped him, sodomized him, and shot him in the head, he said, "I never touched another child." Was he suddenly cured? No. He's afraid of going to jail. The sentences, the minimum sentencing guideline in Minnesota are a disaster. The worst in the country, some say, because judicial discretion can take a criminal and make them invisible. And we don't have the right to do that to the children in Minnesota because they're literally throwing their lives away. That's what happened to me, and we don't want that to happen to anybody else. The governor himself was on the television and said, "I demand reform. This has to stop right now." If you don't pass this bill, if you don't get rid of the weakest sentencing in the country, because in Wisconsin they'll get 3 years, and they'll walk over to Minnesota and get nothing, and they know that, and they do, and there'll be a lifetime registry in Wisconsin, but nothing in Minnesota. If you don't pass this bill, you'll get the next Drew Shadeen, the next Jacob Wetterling, the next Emily Johnson, the next Ashley Mike, the next April Kane. And April Kane is the only name on that list that's alive, and just barely at sometimes. So I ask you to pass this bill and save the children of Minnesota. And it does cost money, and it is controversial, and it's important, and the sentences doesn't work, and the crisis has to stop. And I appreciate you listening to my testimony, and I appreciate you for all the hard work that you do. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. And with that, we will be in recess until 5 p.m. in room 400 South. Everybody is welcome to come back with quite a list.
Just because as Ms. Jern was testifying, I was thinking about, you know, really pretty much, I think any of us who've taken a case to trial know, there's, you know, so much is going on there. And so it's very, very, we just want to be very, very careful about policy making on the basis of these particular situations without actually knowing what was going on in that situation. Was it a mistake? Was it not? What kind of judgment? Was it a good judgment under the scenario, the framework that we have, and therefore we need to make a change? And if so, what is it? And be real careful with that, because people's lives are on the line. And I think we've heard from the testimony and from statements from members of the committee that when we make a change that might at first seem really good in some ways, it could have a very negative effect on the very victim survivors we're wanting to protect, and on future potential victims of the people who we are trying to help. And yet we may find that it's actually the exact opposite effect for that. We want to be treading carefully. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Considine, and then we'll carry the bill over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Representative Zerwas said basically the exact same thing that I wanted to say. It appears to me that the real issue here, once we scratch it all away, is making sure they aren't able to disappear. And so going on a online, as he suggested, and I think Representative Johnson was also going in this direction, that... And I don't believe that's actually part of the bill, is it, Representative?
What is it?
The making sure the information is disseminated so that it can be found.
No, it's not part of the bill.
Okay. I guess I would like to see that as, again, part of the bill, because, again, as you and I have talked, the most significant problem seems to be that they disappear and that there's nowhere to find us out. And so I guess I would agree with Representative Zerwas that we should find a way to make that available to the public.
One of our closing remarks, Representative Gronsell, and then we'll lay the bill over.
The purpose of this bill, Mr. Chair and Committee, was not to throw anybody under the bus. It was not to place blame on anybody. But I've listened to testimony where it seems to me that people are taking offense. The purpose of the bill is to give the victims justice and to hold the criminals accountable. I know there are some people that don't want to look at bills that are increasing penalty for holding people accountable. But clearly, from the testimony from Drew from the BCA, these things are increasing. You can look at these studies that I, examples I've had it on the summers. It's increasing. There's more people exploiting children. There's more people using them in sex acts and selling the videos, selling the pictures. Stays of adjudication does nothing for them. It gives a perception that something has been done on their behalf. And they go out and doing a state of imposition and giving them a misdemeanor versus the felony that they deserve. That's not acceptable. Not by any stretch of the imagination. I serve in law enforcement.
I worked a lot of undercover. I've had to go to places that were tough. I've had to go to calls that were violent, that were shots fired, people with knives, violent people, by myself, because I work in a rural area. I don't look at the county attorney's job as any easier than mine, or the judge's job as any easier than mine. But I did the tough work. I've been shot in the line of duty to serve the public, to help the victims. That's all I'm asking here, is that we not worry about having to do some tough work and to make sure that these victims are getting justice and that these predatory offenders are being held accountable. I'm just going to leave you with one quote. That's from Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I've used it throughout my campaign, and I'll continue to use it because it reminds me of what I need to do. Silence in the face of evil is itself evil. God will not hold us guiltless. Not to speak is to speak. Not to act is to act. We've got to take a hard look at this statute and make sure that victims are receiving justice and not just something that says, you know what, it's the best we could do. Right now, our best isn't good enough because there's too many and the numbers are growing. And we owe it to our children to make sure that we stand up for them. So I thank you for your hearing, and I appreciate everybody's testimony. And I guess I laying it over for possible inclusion.
Hey, thank you, Representative Grosso. With that, we lay over House File 1572 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And meeting adjourned. Thank you.